Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
For me, chicken feet is—it's not just about the loose, rubbery skin and the bones and all that and the sweetness that I love. But I also love the chew and spit style of eating. I love it. I mean, you just sit there and you're kind of, and it's a whole thing, you know. It's sort of like, it's kind of like sucking, chewing, licking, and spitting all at the same time, you know. And I've gotten really good at it, and it's super Asian, and I really dig it.
Today, I am thrilled to be talking to Ivan Orkin, a.k.a. Ivan Ramen. Ivan, a nice Jewish boy from Long Island. I call him the Ramen Whisperer. Orkin started working in Japanese restaurants at the tender age of 15, working as a dishwasher at a Japanese restaurant in his hometown of Syosset. Though he says in his terrific book, Ivan Ramen, Love, Obsession, and Recipes, that he knew deep down by the time he graduated from high school that he wanted to be a cook, he ended up at the University of Colorado studying Japanese. He immediately went to live in Japan after graduation, where his lifelong love affair with Japanese culture and cooking flowered. Ivan first became known in the food world when he opened the first of two ramen shops in Japan. Talk about a fish out of water, or should I say a noodle out of soup. But in fact, his nationality, along with his superb ramen, became his calling card. He became one of the most celebrated ramen shop owners in Japan. Then in 2013, he came back to the States to open his first ramen shop here in New York's Lower East Side. Here to tell us what it's like bouncing back and forth between two very different cultures and a whole lot more is the amazing Ivan Orkin. Welcome to Special Sauce, Ivan.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, it's great
to have you. Thank you for having a studio only two blocks away from my restaurant.
We try to do that.
It's fabulous.
We just rent studios within a two-block radius of whoever we're talking to.
That sounds like a good policy.
You know, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. The book is great. Your ramen, of course, I think is amazing. But let's start with life at the Orkin family table. Reading your book, it doesn't sound like you're eating eel and toro every night for dinner.
No, growing up, my mom hated cooking, and I, for some reason that I still, even though I probably had more therapy than Woody Allen, I have not figured out exactly why, but I equate love and warmth with food. But I grew up in a family that was absolutely not interested in eating, you know.
And neither your mom nor your dad.
Well, I mean, my dad had a couple of dishes that my dad actually liked to cook as a hobby. And so, once a month, or I don't even remember how frequently, but on the weekends he was very famous for meatballs and spaghetti. And to this day, I still think they're some of the best I've ever had. And paella and a couple other things that he would make.
Right.
He had his dishes that he would make.
But food wasn't particularly important to either of them.
Well, it wasn't like when you read about, you know, chefs that have become famous. They really started, you know, next to their grandmother or their mom.
Right.
Or they were the whatever, you know, watching cooking being done. And no, as a matter of fact, when I was 12 or 13, the Swanson Hungry Man dinners came out, probably, circa 1974 or 77, I don't know, whatever it was,
66. Right.
And my mother was so happy to have them. And she, because they would go to the city, they would, you know, we lived on Long Island, but
right.
my dad worked in the city, and my parents were avid followers of all of the arts. And,
right, right. So they went to the theater. Like, my parents went to three restaurants in the 60s. Brittany Dussoir,
yeah.
Seafair of the Aegean,
right.
and the Old Homestead.
Right, okay.
So, like, what were your parents' mainstays?
My dad's mainstay was Restaurant Nippon.
Okay.
Actually, which is, and I had been taken out for Japanese food a bit when I was a kid.
Still there?
It's still there, yep. But that was his spot. I mean, they knew him. He was a regular. He'd walk in, we'd get his table. You know, his office was right nearby, and... he loved it, and he went there for many years. I'm not sure, for them, eating out was sort of a necessary evil.
Right. That's so weird. So how do you think you came to equate food with love and warmth?
I don't know. I honestly have no idea. I know that I very much enjoy eating, and I enjoy, all the activity.
Yeah.
when I was in high school, I had an inkling that I should be in the food business. I had worked at the Tsubo, the Japanese restaurant.
As a dishwasher?
As a dishwasher.
How were you as a dishwasher?
It was mediocre.
Okay.
It was mediocre. I wasn't. I remember once I was terribly in the weeds, and the one of the chefs came into the dish room, and he looked at me, and I think I was probably close to tears. I was so buried. I mean, I just had a stack, literally, you know, like a 4.5-foot stack of things. And,
right.
And he just said, "Ivan-san, move aside." And...
And he took over.
And he knocked out those dishes in, I don't even know, 5 minutes. I mean, all of them, and they were perfect, and they were all stacked perfectly. But moments like that were, I think, why I have this obsession with Japan, because, you know, I was an impressionable, you know, teenager, and I would go to the restaurant, and I think, you know, there were all these things happening in the restaurant, you know. So there was delicious food, which... You know, they let me in on it. You know, I tell my famous story many times. I tell in the book, you know, about you know, the one of the first things I ever ate was when I came, and I was really hungry, and I was just, you know, starving, and I said, "Can I get something to eat?" And the chef, you know, scooped me a bowl of rice, and he whipped up a raw egg with some soy sauce, and he poured it over the rice and sprinkled some powdered seaweed on top.
And it was magic.
I was watching him, like, you know, oh shit, you know. You know, because, you know, this is 1978
right.
or something, and you know eating Rocky had raw eggs. I don't even know. I guess Rocky was already out by then, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that was the only time I ever equated raw eggs with actual consumption.
Right.
But I was also polite, and I was also really hungry. So
right.
I ate it, and I don't know if I loved it, but I liked it. And I was like, and I could see it, like, you know, I've always had a pretty good palate, and I think, and I just appreciate flavors and textures. You know,
yeah.
You know, I think eating is a funny thing. I think everybody likes things that taste good, but not everybody is interested in texture.
Right.
The texture is like the next level of sophistication.
Yes, I think
eating,
so too. You know? And there are things that I can't get past texture-wise. You know, like chicken feet.
I love chicken feet.
I know. See, like, chefs love chicken feet.
Chicken
and I'm
feet's
like,
one of my favorite things to eat.
It's chicken
the whole
feet.
World.
It's just like
it's so good.
Chewing
it's not
cartilage.
Only that. You know what it is? For me, chicken feet is not just about the loose rubbery skin and the bones and all that I also, and the sweetness that I love, but I also love the chew and spit style of eating. I love it. I mean, you just sit there and you're kind of, and it's a whole thing, you know. It's sort of like, it's kind of like sucking, chewing, licking, and spitting all at the same time, you know. And I've gotten really good at it, and it's super Asian, and I really dig it. So I mean, to me, you know, I always eat chicken feet if I'm at a dim sum parlor.
That's hilarious.
But texture in Japan there's a lot of textures in Japan that are super challenging. Things that are like you said, cartilage, you know, I mean, the breastbone cartilage that's salted and grilled on coals. And, you know, I was some American fellow was talking about, and they were like, and people eat cartilage. And I'm looking at them like, yeah, it's awesome. What do you mean? It's like my favorite thing to eat when I go out for yakitori. The first thing I order is cartilage. I mean, it's the great, because it's got a certain kind of...
Yeah.
It's got this, the crunch of cartilage.
But I think you're right. Awesome. It is a level of sophistication that a lot of chefs have reached. And I think I have a pretty good palate, but I can't go there. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I think it's a failure.
I think it's, you know, I always, my anecdote is always that I think that the palate is no different than any other muscle. And if you asked a person to go who, you know, to go pick up a 100-pound box who was weak, they wouldn't be able to budget. But if they went and lifted weights and then they came back 3 months later and they would be able to sort of move it a little bit, and six
sure.
months later they would pick it up and whatever. And it's a little hokey, but that's when I talk to people who want to eat more things but have issues, I say, you know, you can't expect to try something totally new and love it the first time.
Right.
But seeing that people all over the world eat these things and love them, there can't be something wrong with them.
Right.
And if you challenge yourself to eat something that you don't really
like. Yes.
My rule is to eat something that I don't like at least 5 times a year.
Yeah, that's
my rule. I don't have to love it. I don't have to have a whole bowl of it. But I make myself try it again, because you get used to it after a while. And there's a lot of things that I love now that I used to not.
Yeah. You know? Jeffrey Steingarten had a great piece in his first book about this very topic.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about your interest in Japanese culture when your parents took you to Nippon, the restaurant, and when you worked at the Japanese restaurant in Syosset. What about it is so interesting to you?
Well, I think it's a lot of things. I mean, I think when I was a boy at the restaurant, what started everything was just the food, which I was very intrigued by. And I mean, I ate, they would feed me like raw, you know, liver with garlic chopped up all over it. And I ate all different kinds of things, and some I loved and some I didn't like as much. But I liked the challenge of trying all these new things. I was intrigued by the language because it was a real Japanese place. They didn't speak English that well. And the guys were nice to me. Mm-hmm. There were these guys. They were in their late 20s, early 30s. And they kind of, me and my other buddy became the dishwashers of the place, they really took us under their wing. They were nice. They didn't have to be. And right. The owner was like kind of a hard-nosed businesswoman. She didn't like us.
She didn't want to feed you.
She didn't want to feed us. She would be like,
why
are
you? What kind of woman doesn't want to feed her dishwashers?
She was not that nice. But you know what? She was like all business, and you know, they're here to wash the dishes, then send them home. And towards the end of the job, when I decided to leave, she was like, you know, have you come, you know, right before your shift. No more family meal for you. So, you know,
to save 3 cents,
yeah, whatever. But you know, but that didn't matter because the chefs would all roll their eyes and say, don't listen to her. Come over
right.
here. Eat this. Here, come on.
Sure.
Come over here. And they even took us out, you know, to see kung fu movies and eat at all their friends' sushi bars and drink Heineken.
So
and
you
stuff.
Really found yourself immersed in the culture.
Yeah. So enough so that it just left this thing. So once I left the job and I had, you know, 2 or 3 more years of high school after that job, I became something of a sushi aficionado at that point. So by the time I was 17, I would go out with my friends and I would do all the ordering and, you know, and my parents would take me out for sushi and they would go to order the sushi deluxe and I'd say, Mom, I eat by the piece. So I was a pretty obnoxious
That's
teenager.
That's so great. That is the definition.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought maybe they resented the fact that you got kicked out of Hebrew school, but they really resented that you were ordering for them at the sushi bar and you wouldn't let them order the sushi combination.
Well, I let them order. They could do whatever they wanted. I just wasn't eating the sushi deluxe.
So you go to the University of Colorado. You study Japanese. At that point, did you have an inkling that you wanted to be in the food world or not really?
Not really, although almost every single part-time job I ever had in my whole life was food-related. So when I was in a college student, I worked in a health salad business where I made and packaged tabbouleh and tofu salads. It was my friend's mom's business. And then I got another job at a muffin company where I would wash all the baking equipment and then I would wrap and label the muffins.
I mean, you really got pigeonholed as a washer.
Yeah, well, you know, well, when you don't have no skills, that's what you do. It's okay.
Right.
You know, I tell my young cooks now, you know, that, hey, man, trust me. I've cleaned more urinals than you have. Trust me. I've done it all. You know, I'm a 53-year-old. So, I mean, I've done lots and lots and lots of jobs, and I've always had some kind of job. And if it wasn't cooking, it was painting or fixing or cleaning, and I've done it all. We need to remember that this is in the early 80s when being in the food business wasn't sexy.
No, classy.
Or classy, you know.
To your parents, if you would have said, I want to be a chef then, they would have thought you were hurtling
well,
back.
Not my parents, because my parents were super sort of
chill,
liberal and really believed that people should follow their dreams. My mom resented her mother with all the pressure she got. And so I think they were,
they'd be
you
okay.
know, and some of us almost like, well, you should have pushed us a little bit harder, you know, because, you know, my dad was a Harvard grad in Columbia Law and, you know, all scholarships.
Right.
And, you know, they were really hardworking.
And they were wondering, where did Ivan go wrong?
They didn't push any of them. Well, yeah, trust me, until about. Until Ivan Ramen started, and even Ivan Ramen they thought was a dumb idea. So, but you know. So anyway, back then it wasn't a sexy thing to do, and so I wasn't, you know, the thought of it wasn't there wasn't there weren't a lot of role models. There weren't a lot of people who would say that's great. Yeah, you know, you should go for that. And then I think I was scared of it. I think I knew that it wasn't going to be any walk in the park. I worked at Wendy's and I worked at the sushi bar and so I knew how, you know, thankless it could be.
Sure.
And so I think I was intimidated mm-hmm. by the idea of the food business.
Yeah.
And like I said, I wasn't in that world. My friends were lawyers and doctors and you know, whatever, doing all different kinds of everybody was going to good schools and things like that. And so But I still sort of ended up going on my own path because, you know, when I figured, you know, I majored in Japanese for like, you know, I chose Japanese because I failed French in high school and I couldn't graduate college without a language degree. So I had to have a language degree. So when I started looking for colleges, I decided to choose only colleges that offered Japanese, which in 1980, whatever,
fairly limited.
Was limited.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, any of the good schools would probably be no fun for me because I wasn't a great student. So, you know, and I wanted to go
somewhere. By the way, I don't think you would have gotten in, dude.
You know what? I basically barely passed high school. I was maybe the number like 675 out of 678 students.
What happened to the other three guys?
Yeah, and the only reason I graduated was because I threatened the principal to come back. I said, don't expect me to get a GED, my friend. I will be back for every fucking day next year. So that may have had something to do with my passing. But I took a year after high school, and then I went to Nassau Community College.
Sure.
And I did really well.
I got
A pluses in every single class. And
so you had options from there.
Well, back in those days, I mean, you could go to NYU or Columbia if you had all A's from your community college.
Yep.
It didn't matter what your high school was. So I could have gone to a better school than CU, but it made a lot of sense to me, and I knew it was sort of a fun school, and it was supposed to be one of the most beautiful places.
And it is.
And it is. Well, you know, my son goes there now. So,
yeah, really?
Yeah. And so it was sort of like, you know, maybe that's the ticket for me.
Yeah.
And so I... That's sort of how I ended
up. So you were reading Japanese novels, and then you get this degree.
Right.
And you immediately set out.
Well, because I was like any other liberal arts student, you know. You graduate with a BA. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, there's nothing. You know, you get a degree in Chaucer. I mean, there's nothing to do with that. So, and a degree in Japanese was no different, you know, except to go, I figured, go to Japan.
So you went to Japan.
Right. I moved to Japan.
Taught English. Did you know anybody?
Yep, one of my best friends, who was a year ahead of me, had moved to Japan the year earlier, and he offered to let me crash at his place for a while. So I went straight to his place, and I lived with him for a couple of months, and you know, and then landed the Berlitz job, which was back in the day was one of the best places to teach English, and I made a lot of money, and taught a lot of English, and. Enjoyed being in Japan, but, you know, after a while, I just realized that, you know, teaching English wasn't, you know, really floating my boat.
And you say in the book that it really wasn't like being in Japan for most of the people that taught English.
Well, certainly, you know, it's like I was one of those. So there are basically two kinds of expats in Japan. There were the expats who were there because their jobs brought them there, whether they were bankers or whether they were Berlitz teachers. They were able to live within their own personal culture, whether they were Italian or French or American. You could find your group and go places where you didn't really need Japanese. And of course, I loathed those people because I loved Japan. And I would meet them and I'd be like, what was wrong with you? And they'd be like, yeah, we don't really eat Japanese food. We don't really like it. And I'd be like, well, what the hell are you doing? Are you crazy? You know? And then there was the other extreme where, you know, you would meet I met this guy who became a very good friend of mine. And the first hour, we refused to speak English. We only spoke Japanese, you know.
And which neither of you spoke very well.
I spoke well enough.
Yeah.
And we were just speaking in Japanese
because
it's like, I don't want any gaijin friends because I don't want to speak English, you know.
Now, gaijin is the term that Japanese people use for Americans.
No, not Americans. Anybody who's not Japanese.
Anybody who's not Japanese. Got it. Okay.
It's not a term of endearment.
So that I got. So you ended up marrying a Japanese woman, Tammy, is that her name? And you had a son, Isaac.
Yep.
But you weren't exactly setting the world on fire career-wise when you were there, according to your book.
Yeah. No, in Japan, I was just a dude teaching English.
Right.
You know, I mean, it is what it is. You don't really, you know, and Japan, I'm not sure what it's like for expats in other countries, but, you know, Japan's not an easy place if you don't have a visa to strike out. You can't just sort of create a company or, you know, or go work in any kind of place you want. You have to say, I'd like to stay here. And they say, okay, well, who's going to sponsor you? And
sure.
That's why
Got
a lot
it.
Of people would teach English. So you
Got
go
it.
And get, even now, you know, you go get yeah. the school sponsors you and they take responsibility for you. And then you have to work for them a certain number of hours a week. And it's pretty strict. It's only that, you know, years later when I returned as a married, you know, married to a national. And so,
sure, then you become a different...
I mean, now I'm a permanent resident. Yeah, I can do
sure.
whatever I want in Japan.
So you decide you want to go to cooking school.
Yes.
You move your you and your family to the States.
Right.
You go to the CIA.
Right.
Where they're
well,
not...
only my family. I mean, when I was... She was my girlfriend still.
Got
we
it.
Were living in California for a while. I followed her because she got a job
That's
in
right.
California. I followed her to California... And then I was really miserable because I was working for her in this ludicrous business that sold computer parts. And
that you didn't understand.
I still don't that well. But,
right.
you know, yes. I mean, it was selling CPUs
and
DRAM
things that don't
and
exist.
SRAM
DRAMs
and shit that, well, still, yeah. no, it all still exists.
Right.
It's much smaller.
Right.
but it still exists.
Sure.
But it just didn't, you know, it was just... it was something that I did for a year and never, I don't think I ever truly understood what I was even
right.
selling. And I was in great despair because I was in this job that was ridiculous.
That you hated.
It didn't make any sense.
I was terrible at keeping jobs that I hated.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even that. It was sort of messed up as I was working with my girlfriend and I was kind of letting her down because I wasn't really, you know, able to do anything.
Right.
I was just, you know, spinning my wheels and I just didn't, whatever. But so... I just had this epiphany finally that, you know what, I need to go learn how to cook. That's the thing. It's, you know, it's
so you went
that.
To cooking school
yeah.
where they weren't teaching you anything about Japanese food at the CIA.
Oh, God, you know, they had the Oriental Kitchen. And I was like, and I raised my hand and I said, you are aware that people from Asia no longer refer to themselves as Oriental. You know that it's a disparaging term. Maybe you should change it now. Maybe we should call it Asian cookery, which it is now, by the way. But, you know, I was like,
right.
this is like, you know... It's like calling having like a Negro cooking. I mean, we don't do that either. You know?
Right.
It's
yeah.
So it's they
And then you end up in a sort of in a very classical path. You know, you worked at the Mesa Grill. You worked at Lutèce
yep.
in New York.
Yep.
Lutèce was arguably the best, certainly the best French restaurant in America, and maybe the best. One of the best restaurants of any kind in America.
Yeah. It was still at a time where restaurants were much less varied, I think, you know. And I think that Lutèce, with the combination of its food and that whole atmosphere, and, you know, he really had a, you know, a real brigade of servers that were, they were all really good. And then he would come out there. I mean, have you ate a Lutèce
yeah,
when it was
of
open?
Course.
So it was just, you know, he would come out in the hat and the tie,
yeah.
and then it was so white and shiny. And
he was the essence of French chef.
And yet, but his hospitality was really, he was very warm, and he would always look you in the eye and talk to you and make you feel good.
You have very strong feelings about hospitality and your love of it. And do you think that in part it came from André Saltner
Absolutely.
At Lutèce?
Absolutely, 100%. Because I think that, you know, I mean, I'll go even further. I mean, I don't think people go to restaurants to eat. I really don't. I mean, I don't really mean that, but I mean
used to say people go to restaurants to take a couple of hour vacation from their lives.
Yeah, to take a break, and they go to be coddled, and they go to be cared for, and they go to have a different scenery, and they go for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, to me, the hospitality, it's so crucial to, you know, and like I actually get very emotional the more I talk about it. Like sometimes I'll talk about it, like just when you think about a person who, and I tell my staff, I'll say, you know, we get reviewed in the newspaper, they cut it out. Like my mom used to do that, you know, years
sure.
ago when you had before the internet, you know, the only way you remembered anything was by putting a magnet on the refrigerator
sure.
with a note or an article.
Yep.
And that's how you remembered it. And you'd put it on there and you'd walk past it. Every time you took milk out of the fridge, you go, oh yeah, Ivan Ramen, I want to go there. So I'd say, you know, some people, maybe they've been looking at that thing on their refrigerator for 9 months and they finally come. And to me, it's a huge opportunity and it's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
And to say, well, it's just a bowl of ramen or it's like a $20 or $30 meal. What's the big deal or something? Well, it's a huge deal because, first of all, we have no idea how far they came. We have no idea what they went through to come. We have and we have no idea what their finances are. And maybe a bowl of ramen and a beer for them is a giant splurge. And you know, it's one of the things that I've learned over the years is to not be presumptuous. To have the honor of someone being your guest has to be something that you cherish every single time for every single customer that comes through your door every single day. And the minute you stop being a restaurateur, you stop being a chef, and it's something that... And listen, obviously, we all slip up and we get too busy or we forget to greet somebody. Or I mean, nobody's perfect, certainly not me. But
right, because it's just it's an endless series of one-on-one interactions.
Yes, and but you have to remember that you're nothing without your guests. And you're just never, ever going to succeed if people stop coming.
Yeah.
And it's very important to cherish those people. So, you know, I would watch The Chef and, you know, I've never described myself as any one type of cook. You know, there's some cooks, you know, who are like they're that guy, he cooks French or, you know.
Right.
Or Scott Conant, you know, he's Italian. He does Italian or whatever. I mean, we, of course, know that Scott can probably cook anything you want Scott to cook. But to me, I don't see myself as a Japanese cook, really.
No.
I really don't. I mean,
I'm just a chef who
cooks stuff.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, the project turned into ramen. I didn't plan it. It sort of happened. And I was really into ramen at the time.
Yes. And you have this obsessive perfectionist streak clearly in you. Because when I read in the book about how you went about opening your first ramen shop in Japan, which we'll get to in a second, but you were pretty obsessive.
I'm obsessive about, you know what? With my own little voice that I talk to all the time, I'm never good enough, ever. I never do anything good enough. Every single thing I do, the first thing I see is what's wrong with whatever I do and why it has to be fixed.
You're a classic 99, what happened to the other point kind of person.
Because there's always something that could be better.
Yeah. So you end up working at Restaurant Associates, which is this big company that... was eventually sold to an even bigger company, but that ran institutional kitchens, ran restaurants, did all kinds of hospitality. Yeah,
museums, you know, Lincoln Center, they still do corporate cafes, you know, they still do Goldman Sachs, the NFL, things like that. And, you know, it was really a great move. I guess if I could sort of completely rearrange everything I've ever done, you know, maybe I would have stayed in fine dining for another 3 years because I think I would have been a better cook. You know, I could I could be better. I could have, you know, better knife skills. I could have better line skills. There are things I think that I wish I could be a little bit more of a technician. My wife was pregnant with my first child and the offers from the fine dining restaurants I visited that were willing to hire me was, you know, $200 take home for working 60, 70 hours a week. And I just said, you know, I can't do this.
The math doesn't work.
Yeah, I just said, you know what? I was older because I didn't go to culinary school after high school. I went 10 years later. So, I mean, even more than that. So, I mean, I wasn't so young anymore either. And it ended up being, you know, a great 10-year break.
Yeah.
I went and it was 6 to 3, 5 days a week. I got a very nice salary. I worked for a Wall Street firm, so I got a big giant bonus when they were all dancing around with a lot of money. They would say, well, let's give Ivan some too. And I always got a big check and it was a good gig.
Yeah. But then tragedy befell you. You know, your wife died.
She died of toxic shock during a trade show. And no one was really sure why, but she was pregnant with my second child because Isaac was already was a little older than two, probably 2 and 3 months
I mean, you know, I mean, I've suffered a fair amount of loss in my life, but never quite anything like that. I mean, how do you go about sort of putting one foot in front of the other?
Well, I was very lucky. I mean, look, I'm the kind of a guy who's a glass half full person. You know, hey, listen, shortly after she died, I read a newspaper article about a pregnant woman with her 2 or 3 children crossing the street and they got hit by a car and they all died. And I was like, huh?
Right.
Wow, I guess I'm kind of lucky. I had a boy who was beautiful and gave me all the reasons I needed to, you know, soldier on. And I had have a very close family. And I lived, you know, they all lived around me. My parents lived three blocks from me in Park Slope. And I was able to have, and I worked for Restaurant Associates, which turned out to be the greatest move of all time because they could afford to pay me.
Sure.
It wasn't like a restaurant where they would have said, you know, we're so sorry for you, but we can't pay you.
And, right.
You know, they said full pay, don't come back.
Right.
We don't want to see you for a month. Just go get your shit together. On the day of the funeral, they rolled up in a van with so much food, and it was the heaviest rain I've almost seen in my entire life. It was
wow.
really almost something out of a movie. And they showed up, and they were all crying. And it was just like this incredible, like, this
wow.
moment. And they all came and just laid out this gorgeous spread for all my guests from the funeral. And it was a really great company, and I had great insurance. And they let me come in a little bit later so my babysitter could come in on time. And they let me go home earlier if I needed to. It was a great job.
Wow.
I mean, it really was. And you know, working in an institutional kind of thing is not sexy. I mean, probably my biggest disappointment of the whole job was just that there was the urgency is different. And, you know, when you work in a restaurant, it's really exciting because you
right.
have this urgency.
You're putting
urgency.
On a show every
yeah,
night.
You have to really, yeah. you know, and it's different. But I got to be a different person for a while.
Yeah.
And which was also good.
Which
and,
is probably and, what you needed at that moment.
Yep. Yeah, and I did. And it really, it allowed me to sort of rebuild my life after everything happened and move forward. And it was good. It was
and
good
then time. You're sort of bouncing back and forth to Japan.
A little bit. I would visit to see my kid. I would take my when someone that close to you dies, you know, you lose a lot of things. You don't just lose your partner, you know, you lose marriage, which is, you know, being a husband to someone is an identity. And having we shared, you know, this Japanese culture. You know, that I didn't necessarily bring to the table, my wife brought to the table. So, you know, we would eat Japanese food and every week we would watch a Japanese drama together and we would listen to Japanese pop music.
Right.
And there were like all these things we did that were very Japanese. So that when she died, you know, I didn't have a big group of Japanese friends. That was my connection to Japan. So when she died, I sort of lost that and I was very lonely for it. You know, so there were all these things that I grieved over. It wasn't just
right.
her absence. It was a lot of things. And so I think part of my healing process was to go to Japan, you know, once or twice a year and just
see your in-laws.
See my in-laws and see our old friends and just hang out there and sort of get reconnected. You know?
Yeah. And then you meet another Japanese woman.
Yeah. Yep, not on purpose. I mean, I didn't actually dated lots of different kinds of women. I just, I happened to have, you know.
You didn't only look in the Japanese woman section?
No, Match.com. No, I didn't. And I did J-date. I did all, it was really horrible. I hate dating. Dating's horrible, you know. I like fooling around. But I, you know, and that the whole game is kind of
yeah.
fun.
So you met.
But I don't like dating. I met her on a trip to Tokyo.
Her name is Mari.
Mari, and I met her on a trip to Tokyo, and she already had a son, but she was out of a relationship, and so we, you know, I met her. I was like, oh my God, this is it, but we had this crazy 5-day. Affair where we were together every minute, and then I went home, and then I called her all the time, and then I was like, I want to go back, and everybody was like, but that's ridiculous, you can't, she lives too far away, it doesn't work, and then
right, and what are you going to do with your son,
and then I just said, and then I talked to a friend of mine who always lived outside the box, and he said, dude, it's a new world, man, get on a fucking plane, just go back. What's the problem? And I was like, you're right. I can just like get on the plane and go back. And so I said, Mom, I'm going to go back and see Madi. And my mom said, that's ridiculous. And I'm very angry at you. And I won't help. I'm not watching Isaac. And I said, well, go fuck yourself. And I called my sister and I said, could you please watch Isaac? And she said, yes. And I said, bye.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went back and I met her parents and her brother and she came back, you know, I met her, we met in late May and I visited her in early June and then she came in mid-July and then we got married in early August.
Wow, that's a whirlwind
yeah.
transcontinental courtship.
And then she moved on wedding day. She moved all her stuff back, and we've been married for almost 15 years.
Wow.
Ed Levine continues his conversation with Ivan Orkin next week when Ivan rises to become the Ramen King.